From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik.
When they occur, presidential transitions are the biggest, most important takeover of any organization in history. But for decades, they were done in an incredibly dangerous way. Very little preparation, little institutional support, and hardly any experts to help guide the way. Max Steyer, the president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, has been raising the alarm on haphazard nature of transitions for years and has started an initiative several years ago to be the primary resource and knowledge repository on transitions to fill this really enormous gap. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Surprise, I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman, Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Partnership. And for today's show, I have convinced somehow your normal host, Dave Marchik, to let me do a much less important takeover, sitting in the interviewer chair to dive into the history of the Center for Presidential Transition and how it's evolved to support the radically shifting agency and presidential campaign needs every 4 years. Joining me for this discussion are, not surprisingly, none other than Max Steyer, founder and president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, and your very own David Marchik, who I will reintroduce to the audience, not as your host today, but a retired executive from the Carlyle Group who is serving as a volunteer director for the Center for Presidential Transition. Max, thanks so much for joining us today. And Dave, I really appreciate you being willing to give up your interviewer chair.
It's a definite improvement. So they may not let me back.
We'll see how it goes. Who knows? You haven't heard my entire spiel yet. So Max, to set the stage, I want to remind our listeners that for a long time, and even among some audiences today, transition planning by presidential campaigns was seen as presumptuous, the political version of counting transitions before they're hatched. Get caught doing it, and you get tagged as arrogant, as measuring the drapes, as being very brazen before you've even won office. And getting people comfortable with transition planning early and responsibly was at one point really uncomfortable for a status-conscious Washington. So with that context in mind, Max, I would love to hear more about, why did you launch the center? What was it that drove you to think that we needed an initiative to get Washington comfortable transition planning and to get them doing it better?
Well, Lauren, thank you so much. And Dave, thank you for creating this wonderful podcast and taking the center to new heights and making such a big difference. So, Lauren, your question, which is, why did we start on presidential transition? The answer is that one of our colleagues, Katie Maleg, came to me in 2008 and said, what are we going to do? We had started as an organization in 2001. We had only been around for a single administration. And her question was, what happens when we have a new administration? Is there anything we should be doing about it? And that question kicked off an investigation on our part to figure out what we should be doing as an organization focused on making the government work better. Was there something we should be doing to help the transition work better? And we quickly realized just what you identified, and that is that transitions were historically Groundhog Day exercises, that there was no learning system, no resource that someone could go to and learn how to do this better, no guidebook. And we, you know, did the right thing, which is to study first. And in 2008, we contacted the campaigns and invited all the people who had done transition before who would speak to us together for a conference at the Pocanico Hills facility that the Rockefeller Brothers Fund ran. And that was the starter's pistol for, you know, what has turned into an incredibly valuable and meaningful exercise, the Center for Presidential Transition.
So Max, as you were studying and talking to folks who had gone through this experience before, did you encounter any, I guess I would call them horror stories, that really drove the impetus behind this initiative and drove you to expand it significantly over the years? Are people who've come out of this transition experience, have they come to the realization also that it's absolutely necessary to plan and to rely on resources like the center?
So plenty of horror stories. Dave has done a remarkable job of collecting them, and those that have not heard the podcast series in total get that opportunity, because you get lots of chilling examples of transition and stuff that has not gone well. What we realized, again, was just what you described, and that is that pretty much every campaign understood that job number one was to win the campaign, and they were not willing to invest, certainly publicly or significantly, in any effort that they saw that might jeopardize that work. And so they would not do transition planning pre-election at scale or publicly for fear that they would be accused of measuring the drapes. I mentioned that we began our work in 2008. We began working significantly with the Obama team, Chris Liu and company, and the McCain team, Will Ball. And they were great examples of really exceptional people, but with fairly limited resourcing to do what was an enormous task and real no blueprint for how to do it well. And Dave cites this stat, which I think tells the story in full, in my view, on the horror side. And that is, we know that there are 1,250 Senate-confirmed position that every administration needs to fill, and that the high watermark for doing that was the Obama administration in 2009. And in their first 100 days of that 1,250 positions, they got 69 filled. They did an incredible job. They did it better than anyone else had. And yet, if you look at what really needs to get done, it still wasn't close to what we should want as a public in terms of our leadership team in place in real time. And so that was motivation enough. What we realized is that there are two things that needed to happen. One, we need a playbook for those that were actually operating transitions going forward. And we needed to change the operating rules themselves, because the rules were a disincentive for the kind of transition, early transition planning that we needed to see.
So you talked about starting this conversation at the partnership in 2008. This was coincidentally when I was working on a transition effort within the Department of Defense to think about how to bring in the Obama administration at the end of the Bush administration. And I vividly remember, even though I worked in the office dedicated to transition, that I had full authorization to do work on this, consulting with lawyers constantly to make sure that I was not overstepping anything, and just being surrounded by a lot of people who knew this was important, but also were very uncomfortable with how to execute. So I you've been through multiple cycles now at the partnership and seen the work on transition evolve at the center, but also seen how campaigns and government evolved in their transition effort. I'm curious, can you talk about like some of those changes, not only as a result of the legislation that has been passed, but also just in terms of how they've learned from one another from cycle to cycle?
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal to see. And again, I used the Groundhog Day metaphor earlier. And I think that cycle has been broken, so that every cycle, the knowledge base has gotten larger and transition preparation has gotten better. And it really begins in 2012 with the Romney transition, the readiness project that they led, and Mike Leavitt and Chris Liddell being the two executives in charge. And they moved the ball forward in a very dramatic way. Most importantly, they started earlier, more aggressively, and publicly. They were willing to raise the flag that this was something that was not to be done in the dead of the night, but rather a requirement for taking campaigning seriously, that you were actually ready to govern if you won. In 2016, we saw not just a challenger, single challenger, doing this kind of aggressive transition planning, but we saw the entire field thinking about that. And so one of my favorite memories of all the things that I've done at the partnership was in 2016, the same gathering that I discussed that we had done in 2008 with the Obama and the McCain campaign transition teams. We did in 2016, we actually had five campaigns represented at a very senior level. They included the Trump campaign, the Kasich campaign, the Cruz campaign on the Republican side, and on the Democratic side, the Sanders campaign and the Clinton campaign. And this was in the spring of 2016, in the heat of the primary season, when there was a lot of rough and tumble happening on both sides. And you had, as I said, very senior people from all five of those campaigns in a room together for a day and a half. And as one of the participants said, everyone has left their swords at the door. And to me, that was a dramatic moment of change. They were all there because they understood whoever won, we needed to make sure that our president was ready. And for them to be ready, they had to actively prepare, even pre-election, for taking over the government. And that, to me, was a sea change. And we've seen it now in the 2020 cycle that Dave can speak to in much better depth than I can.
Dave, this is actually a great transition. I wanted to get to you because even with this tremendous progress in transition knowledge, planning, and acceptance across government, across the media, and across the campaigns themselves, this is still an enormous undertaking. And I have to ask, how is it that you got into the Center for Presidential Transition? How did Max talk you into taking on a really fantastic and inspiring, but also enormous job that has involved so much work at the partnership and elsewhere over the last several months?
Well, thanks for hosting, Lauren. And I think that if anybody's listened to the first 15 minutes or so, they'll realize that you're a lot better at this than I am. And so this may be my last podcast. So I want to thank everybody for listening to this point. I have known Max and admired his work and the partnership's work for some time. We have many friends in common. And I just felt like he did such a great job and the partnership did such important work. And we were having breakfast. I had kind of retired from Carlisle and was teaching and serving on boards and doing some nonprofit work and part-time practicing law. And we had breakfast and Max said, hey, do you know anybody that could do this work? I need someone to lead the center. And I said, okay, let me think about it. And the end of the breakfast, he said, well, why don't you do it? You're not that busy and you'd be good. And so I said, I'm not really looking to do anything. I just left and I want to have some time. I want to figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life. And basically I've been on planes for 25 years and I'd like to work a little less for a little period of time. And then I thought about it and I did some reading and the more I learned, the more excited I was because I wanted to do something public service oriented. I wanted to do something that was truly nonpartisan and bipartisan. I wanted to do something value added for the public good. And I wanted to do something where I learned a lot. And so all of those objectives have been met and, you know, in spades with this role. And it's been a privilege and a lot of fun. And the best thing is I've learned a ton.
So you mentioned that you had just retired from Carlisle. And actually, one of the two things I wanted to ask you was, first, you know, in the years that you spent there, was presidential transition something that the leadership team at Carlisle or the folks who worked there, did they think about it a lot? I'm sure they thought about it in terms of policy shifts, but did they think about the actual mechanics of transition and how and whether those were important to what they did every day?
We never really thought about presidential transitions there. What I did learn a lot about at Carlisle was CEO and leadership transitions, because Carlisle, when I was there, we owned 220 to 240 companies at a time all around the world. And about a third of those companies, we had leadership changes. Either someone resigned or we wanted a change or we wanted something new, or we would buy a division of a company, carve it out, and we would need to install a CEO. And I'd served on a number of corporate boards and had been part of leadership changes. And what I saw was that even in the private sector, leadership changes, transitions are excruciatingly difficult. And in the public sector, they are even more difficult just because of, as you said at the beginning, the size, breadth, scope, and complexity of a takeover of a new government is just, it's not replicated anywhere in the world. In fact, from a management perspective, if you looked at the blueprint for how a presidential transition is organized, you would say, who in the heck designed it this way? This is crazy.
This is something that whenever I teach, I always talk to my students about. You know, imagine if a company had a transition such that it lopped off its entire C-suite and then some, and all of the managers within and the vice presidents and so on, and had very little time to have any sort of ingoing, outgoing meetings of any kind, thinking that that was a good way to do business, or a football team deciding that we're getting rid of our tight end, our quarterback, our coach, and a few others. And by the way, you're not going to have any time to talk before the next game. And this is the logic that you see in sort of the cultural appreciation of transition in the past that has evolved so much and so much thanks to the work that the partnership has done. So Max, I wanted to turn to you, but also I really hear from both of you on this, and that is how the center has changed over the last four cycles of election. And what do you think is possible now to do in terms of transition work, transition advice, transition resources that was not possible four cycles ago, whether because of the legislation changes, but also some of the capacity changes that we've seen at the partnership in that time period.
So I can start, and Dave will undoubtedly have some good insight beyond what I will offer. I do think it's getting better and better, and this cycle obviously presents some particular challenges that we may go into later. But I think what we've seen is just a blossoming of understanding the opportunities for improvement. And as again, I think these exist both legislatively or structurally, and then operationally. On the operational side, I mentioned at the front end, there was no playbook for what a campaign transition operation should be doing. And I think we're on version 4.0 right now. But we also came to realize over time that that was a critical constituency, but not the only one. And that the career workforce that was responsible for setting up all the transition information agency by agency was doing it agency by agency with no consistency and again, with no playbook. And so we created, and this is with the help of the Boston Consulting Group, a playbook for agencies to understand how they should best prepare, and one that had some consistency across the board. And we began bringing those folks together. So that would be an example of an improvement. This last cycle, I think we recognized that there was also, in fact, a transition that took place between an incumbent president first term and then their second term, which is again something that had not been on our radar screen previously. So if you think back to 2012, we worked with the Obama administration around what kind of support they would need to give to a challenger if they won, but we didn't really engage much on the question about what they should be doing to better prepare for a second term. And that's all material that this last cycle we've been building out. And so I think it's, as I said earlier, the metaphor for me is really a learning system. And we're seeing how in each cycle, we're able to build on top of what we knew the last time and make it way better. I don't think we're close to reaching sort of management nirvana on the transition side, either in the operational aspects of it or in the structural one. And on the structural side, I think one of the things that we need to see changed is just the number of political appointees more broadly. I don't think it works. I think having, you know, 4,000 political appointees and 1,250 that have to go through Senate confirmation is actually the right way for us to be running our government in a world in which the risks are so large and fast moving.
I'm going through a hiring process right now where I'm hiring three people at a time. And I had gotten a briefing on transition just like a little while after doing an interview, and realized the scale at which the administration, Congress, and effectively the American people have to be doing their own set of interviews for that number of political appointees. It's absolutely insane to think about doing effectively and doing responsibly. So Dave, to build on that, can you tell us a bit more about some of the innovations that you've seen in this cycle in transition planning, whether it be related to new authorities, experience, or also I think technology can play a big role that was not capitalized on in the past?
Sure. Well, let me start with adding a little to what Max talked about as an innovation, which is to focus on second-term planning. So, you know, the partnership had worked closely with challengers in previous cycles. What we did is we did a lot of work to understand the change between a first term and a second term. And that started with talking to people that have managed that transition. And so, for example, on one of our early transition labs, we had Josh Bolton and Dennis McDonough, chiefs of staff, respectively, for George W. Bush and for Barack Obama. And they basically said, you know, we spent a lot of time working on the transition to year one, but we didn't spend a lot of time in year four working on the transition to year five, and I wish we did more. And so we looked at the data, and what we found is that if you take the top officials across the government, almost half of them, half, leave between the day the president is sworn in for his second term and 6 months. And so in a typical year, a new president in year one nominates around 700 individuals. In a typical fifth year, they nominate around 500. If President Trump wins re-election, his job will be more akin to a first year because he has about 150, 160 positions where there's no incumbent, there's no nominee, there's no plan for someone to take that role. And so if he wants to fill these seats, he's going to have to appoint somewhere in the 650 to 700 range. A second innovation, I would say, is an enhancement of what already existed, but clarity about the important role of career officials. So Max mentioned the Presidential Transition Act. It was adopted in 1963. It's been amended five or six times. The latest amendments were signed into law earlier this year. And there are two important words in that law: career officials. The amendments vest clear authority around the agencies with career officials. And that's critical because transitions have been traditionally nonpartisan, nonpolitical, continuity of government exercises. And the law affirms that. A third is, I think, that we've had a much more significant public education about the importance of transitions. And this gets to the point that you and Max talked about earlier, which is we want candidates to measure the drapes. We want them to plan. And public education really helps that. So the podcasts, for example, they've been downloaded 50,000 times. That's incredible how kind of a geeky subject like transitions could be of interest to a broader population. We had an event a couple of weeks ago about transition planning, and we had 6,000 people watch it live, which is incredible. And then the final innovation, which I don't think any of us was prepared for when we started this work in this cycle, was how to do a virtual transition. And so, you know, I started this role in October. There were people on the team, Shannon Carroll, Christine Simmons, Dan Hyman, and others who had been working on this for 4 years. And then March 12th, March 13th came along, and we shut down our offices. And about a month later, we had this event that Max talked about, this, you know, summit to convene all the relevant experts on transition planning. And we talked about the potential to plan for a virtual transition. And at that point, everybody thought, well, this pandemic's going to be a month or two, we'll be back to work. And so this was a possibility. Now it's a probability. And I think all three constituencies, the Trump White House, the agencies, and the Biden team, are prepared to plan a virtual transition.
It's just incredible to think about. You're exactly right. In March, so many of us were in a different place then and thinking that this would be over soon. We would be going back to the offices and everything would be normal. And all the adjustments that we've had to make along the way, I think, as you say, both teams are doing, or all the above teams are doing, an incredible job at adapting to that. So speaking of things that have been challenging, I want to ask a more difficult question and hear from both of you about what keeps you up at night about transition. What are the things that you worry about the most, particularly ones that you think most or others are not paying attention to in the transition space?
So if it's a difficult question, I say, Dave, you go first.
Okay. I think there are two things that worry me. One is the big stuff, and one is the small stuff. So obviously the peaceful transition of power, as Ken Burns talked about on our podcast, is one of the bedrocks of American democracy. You know, Ken said this best. He said that for 223 years, we've had no shots fired, no troops alerted. We've had smooth transitions since Washington handed the keys to Adams. We've had presidents leave unhappily, but they always left. And so obviously talk about not recognizing the will of the American people is troubling. What I've seen below the surface, below the rhetoric, is everybody working effectively. People in the White House, people in the agencies, people in the Biden team working heads down, preparing for every eventuality. So I'm hopeful that the rhetoric will tone down, but it makes everybody nervous. I'm pleased, again, that the work's getting done. And then the second thing is just the small things. You know, will technology work? Will security clearances be granted? Will the Senate be able to act with speed to confirm people? As Max said, the Senate operates glacially to confirm people, and in a remote environment, it can operate even slower. And so those are the things that I worry about. But fortunately, notwithstanding the rhetoric, people have been focused on the work, and each side is prepared to govern, hopefully, on January 20th.
What about you, Max?
I think the fundamental worry that I have is you know, goes back to the purpose of the transition and our government more generally. And that is, it's there to solve our big problems. We are in the middle of a pandemic, of an economic crisis. Racial equity issues are profound in our country. We don't know what other future problems are around the corner, whether it's a national security issue, you know, spawned by the nature of the pandemic being a global destabilizing force, who knows? And this is a time of maximum vulnerability. So the biggest worry for me is making sure that whoever is president next is in fact ready to govern on day one. And I think that, you know, we've made real progress in terms of understanding how to do this process better. I think the Biden team has really jumped in with an extraordinary effort, and they are doing great work. The reality is that the lift is so large that it is scary to think about what's in fact required in ordinary times, and even more so today, where you have these additional really scary requirements, both in terms of the challenges that must be met out of the gate, as well as the operating difficulties. You know, so that to me is the core issue here. You know, will the next leadership team be ready to address these truly horrific and complex problems immediately? And also think about the longer term. How do we improve the governance of our government? How do we address, you know, future transitions so that they are done more easily, address some of these leadership questions we talked about, you know, really changing the requirements here. So you're not having to have, you know, 4,000 people moved in and out on the turn of a dime.
President Kennedy had a line about how there's no training school for presidents when he was doing a bit of reflection on his own feeling of preparation or lack of preparation going into office. And there is no training school, but there is the training wheels to some degree of the career workforce. And that, to reflect on a point that both of you have made earlier, the career workforce, both the civilian and the military side, they're what allow a peaceful transition of power between two administrations who may not necessarily agree on much or may not necessarily get along on a personal level, but allow that continuity between the two. So Dave, you've talked about the career workforce. Max, you've mentioned them as well, but I wondered if you both might reflect a little bit more on what it is the career workforce does in a transition, the role that they have, particularly one where there may be crises going on, as Max discussed, or we may be facing challenges, whether technical or otherwise, in the actual mechanics of transition.
So there are literally hundreds and hundreds of people across the federal government working on transition as we speak. The partnership convenes something called the Agency Transition Roundtable, which Dan Hyman coordinates. And we invite representatives from multiple agencies. We regularly have 60 or 70 agencies and 120, 130 people on those calls talking about all the stuff they need to get done. The other interesting thing is that there are two statutory positions with responsibility for transition planning. One of them is called the Federal Transition Coordinator. That's a career position. It's currently held by Mary Jabert, who I've gotten to know through this process. She's just an extraordinary civil servant. If you looked up civil servant in the dictionary, and it gave you the definition of what you want, someone that's nonpartisan, someone that's serious, someone that's focused, someone that's hardworking, you would get a picture of Mary Jabert. And you know, throughout the cycle, I've talked to her sometimes at 5:30 in the morning, sometimes at 10 at night, sometimes late on a Sunday night. She is working hard to prepare for every eventuality. What the career workforce does is prepare for either outcome, a Trump win or a Biden victory. And in a Trump win, they'll need to work on a second term agenda. They'll need to help process personnel. They'll need to get new teams in, because typically about half the cabinet leaves. And so they are preparing for that possibility. If Biden wins, the day after the election, or the day after the election of called, if it takes a couple days, there will be hundreds and hundreds of people from the Biden team landing, in this case virtually, on those agencies to work with the agencies to find out what's going on, what's hitting the fan, what's coming in 30, 60, 90 days, what are the big problems. And then finally, I'd say, you know, if there's a change in administration, there will be really, really important work to reinvest, revitalize, and re-energize the agencies, because it's been a very, very difficult period for career officials.
So I will just jump in, because if you say career workforce, then I immediately think that I have to say something because it's so important. So Lauren, thank you for for raising the topic. And Dave obviously did a great job of covering, you know, how fundamental the career workforce is in the transition process. I think it's also worth coming back to this question about this whole process in general, that we tend to focus on election and we tend to focus on the political team. But I think we have a government that we need that is largely run and staffed by career professionals. And I think you look at someone like Dr. Fauci is a prime example of that, who has spent his career developing an incredible expertise and then serving the public over many, many decades. I think that we need to revisit this question about how many political appointees that we have, not only as an operating matter, how difficult it is to bring the 4,000 in real time, but also as a matter of ensuring that we have the right balance of capability inside our government. There is no other democracy that I'm aware of that has the level and number of political appointees that we have. I think that the nature of the government's authority in terms of the dealing with the problems that we have today requires actually fewer political appointees so that we can have more expertise in decision-making decision-making roles. So when you say career workforce, I think the most important thing that a new political team or any political team can do is to connect well with that career workforce, recognize that it is the most vital asset they have in succeeding as leaders in those organizations, and making sure that they're listening carefully to that expertise and advice. We do need to refresh the workforce. We do need to invest in the people of our government, as Dave just suggested. And we need to recognize them when they do extraordinary work. We have lots of systems in place to identify problems, not very much in the way of identifying the great work that's being done. And I think we will have a better government if we, in fact, honor those that are doing well and not simply find problems.
Thanks, Max. So it's tough to imagine, given that I think many of us feel the election season has been going on for so long, but at some point we will hit the election, we will hit inauguration day, and the new administration will come in, as Max said, hopefully be ready to govern and ready to engage that career workforce. But I have a question for you, Dave, and this is probably not something that either transition team is thinking about much right now, but are there things that a future administration, or maybe with a future Congress, could do to better support transitions in the future? Are there regulatory or legal changes or other kinds of preparation they could make in advance that may ease some of the transition planning work that's going on, understanding how much improvement that has gone on in the last several years?
It's a great question. You know, what's happened with the evolution of the Transition Act, particularly after Bush v. Gore, is that a lot of the post-election activities were moved to pre-election. So, for example, Bush didn't have all of his national security officials in place on September 11th, in part because he had a shortened transition and because it takes a long time to get security clearances. And so in 2004, Congress passed a law to give the challenger the right to process security clearances so they're ready the day after the election and the day of the inauguration. I think that more of the post-election activities that are kind of typically executed can be accelerated in the same spirit. I also think that there can be more money. So right now, a transition costs somewhere between $8 to $10 million, and a good chunk of that comes from the federal government, from the Congress. It's really not enough. These teams need to be larger. They need to be more significant. They rely a lot on volunteers, which means you get either people that are really wealthy and that can afford the time, or people that are willing to eat ramen like I did when I started in government in 1993. I lived in a basement apartment and ate ramen pretty much every night because I had no money. And so having more money earlier will give the candidate the ability to hire people, give them health care, and have a professional staff leading up to the election so that they can have a more robust, more experienced transition team that can attract the best and the brightest.
Right. And as you say, that is perhaps more representative of the American people in so many ways too. So Max, as a final question, I'm going to give you a chance to make a plug. I know that the partnership has been doing a tremendous amount of work on those big challenges that a next administration, regardless of who wins, is going to face, and the initiatives that they should pursue early on in order to take on some of those big challenges. Can you just give us a quick recap of what are those big things that any administration absolutely must take on in those first months of an administration? And do you have any quick tips of things that you think that they should add to their to-do list in those first 100 days or so to make any administration successful in those efforts?
Lauren, yeah, I'm assuming that we get to have a two-hour podcast right now because it's difficult on this topic. But look, I think that the most important point is conceptual, and that is that most political teams come in with a very long laundry list of policies that they want to pursue, and there's typically not all that much attention paid to the operational necessities of making any of that policy real. And I think Obamacare is probably a poster child for this in terms of, you know, huge policy fight ultimately resolved in favor of the government doing more, but not a lot of work done figuring out what you needed to do to execute, to deliver, and then some problems at the front end as a result of that. So I think investing first and foremost in people who understand large organizational management issues, which are everywhere in government. Tendency a lot of times is for administrations to bring in lots of, you know, smart policy people. They already exist in government. You don't actually need them. You need people who can deploy the resources, that amazing career workforce, against the problems of the day. So that would be point number one. Point number two would be to build that relationship very early on with that career workforce, recognizing that it begins in the transition, that the agency review process that Dave described is really an onboarding experience for a new administration, first and foremost. Third would be to work across the silos. One of the big issues that exists are that today's problems don't respect the legacy lines that make up the formation of our government. Something like the pandemic or any other big issue, climate change, you name it, it actually requires many, many agencies, relationship with Congress, intergovernmental activity, public-private relationship. So building again that relationship and team capability across any new leadership team is truly important. And I think that modernizing the rules of government will be fundamental here as well, that we have an exceptional group of people who need to be operating in a more modern environment. That includes technology, but in the operating rules too. The last major reform of talent, the talent rules themselves, was over 40 years ago. We still have a pay system that comes from 1949. It makes no sense. We need to truly invest in a more modern government if we're going to deal with the problems of today and tomorrow.
Well, Max and Dave, I cheated a bit. In my podcast, this is the point at which we would talk about pop culture. So I'm going to sneak in one more surprise question for you both and ask, which TV show or movie is your favorite about the American presidency? And I'll go ahead and tell you mine. Mine is The American President, or An American President, Annette Bening. I love that movie. Watch it anytime it comes on television, no question. Dave?
Dave was a pretty good movie.
Oh, well, you know, I'm shocked. and it's about transitions, too.
And I remember that Kevin Kline, well, was a body double, and he looked at the finances. He was an accountant before he went in to be president. And he looked at the finance and said, who came up with this? Who balanced these books? These are wrong. And so that was my experience when I worked in government as well.
Max?
Well, I have to go with The West Wing. And I have to admit that I am not as educated on any topic, including popular culture, as the two of you. But what I was excited by in that program is that it excited a generation of people who watched it to think about government differently as an exciting work environment. Obviously, it was largely focused on the political, not so much on all that was going on at the career level, but I think it really helped set a different mindset about the value of government, and we need to see a positive and focused mindset today.
And I've always considered Max the Rob Lowe of good government circles.
Absolutely. No question. Well, Max Steyer, President and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service, and Dave Marchick, whose chair I stole to co-host this podcast today, who is now acting as the Director for the Center for Presidential Transition. Thank you both so much. I'm delighted to be able to sit in the interviewer chair, and I've learned so much from you both today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.